Howdy folks, welcome to Lords of Order, a DC's Dr. Fate fan podcast. I'm your host, Ed Moore, and there will be spoilers. If you need to get in touch, the website is bigtimenoise.com/Dr. Fate. The email address, thedrfatefanpodcast@gmail.com. Teal Productions and Lords of Order are places on Facebook, pages there that you can get in touch with me. And on Twitter, Teal Productions. In both cases, Teal is spelled like the color, T-E-A-L. Looking at All-Star Comics, the 1976 volume, issue number 63. It was cover dated November-December 1976. The on-sale date was August 17th, 1976. This is coming to us from writer Paul Levitz, penciler Keith Giffen, inker Wally Wood, colorist Carl Gafford, and letterer Ben Oda. And I will say, I do much more enjoy this portion of Keith Giffen's career than the, what is it, five years later, Legion, and the Trencher early Image Keith Giffen. That art style I didn't really like that much. But this is cool. On the front page, we have an image of Solomon Grundy punching the heck out of Hawkman, grabbing Wildcat by the leg, probably getting ready to sling him around, with Power Girl coming from behind Solomon Grundy to help him, and the Fiddler standing off here to the side. The Fiddler's saying, "And then the Injustice Gang will take over the world." And Solomon Grundy says, "Solomon Grundy will smash you all, puny heroes," or something like that. Down at the bottom, we have a little inset window. "You dare not miss the death of Dr. Fate." And it's an image of Kent Nelson laying on a medical bay bed of some sort. Now, this issue picks up pretty much where last issue stopped. Wildcat, being controlled by the Fiddler Fiddling, was attacking Hawkman. Solomon Grundy standing to the side just watching, as he's not necessary for the show yet. For the show? Ooh, for the comic, the story yet. And Hawkman is beseeching Wildcat to fight it, to stop, because you know you can, you're stronger than... But to no avail. With two or three quick punches, Wildcat knocks out Hawkman. Everyone, including Wildcat, believing that Hawkman is dead. Once that is accomplished, the Fiddler stops fiddling. Wildcat comes to his senses and attacks him, knocking him through and about some crates that are here on the seaside wharf, where they're all gathered as of last issue. But just as Wildcat seems to be winning against the Fiddler, Solomon Grundy steps up and starts smashing and kicking and punching, and with a final backhand and a K-E-R-S-H-L-A-M, kerslam, that's the sound of Solomon Grundy backfisting Wildcat, or backhanding, I guess it looks like. Then Solomon Grundy says, "Cat has made Grundy mad," in the last panel of the page. The marshland monster is not life as we know it. His grisly, inhuman eyes glow with a light that we could only call supernatural, the narrator tells us. The fight continues. Now we're with seeing things from Wildcat's perspective, as he's not really sure what he's going to do about Grundy. All he knows is to keep fighting, being a former heavyweight champion of the world and no powers other than his own martial prowess. Wildcat fights probably the biggest superpower, and I'm throwing up the quotes here, that Wildcat is his spirit, his will to continue going. So he's often the moral, but not moral as in good and bad, moral as in what we should do, guidance for any team that he's on. As far as his good or bad, you know, definition of moral, a Wildcat kind of leans to the rather right conservative side. So he's kind of used, and in this series, that is his position opposite what we are coming to find out is Power Girl's perceived, I think, or implied more left-leaning liberal tendencies. And I say that with caution, because I don't necessarily know that that is a fair comparison, but I believe at this time, 1976, that is the way that the comparison is being forced on us. So all of this, of course, being said with both 55-year-old white male Anglo-Saxon Protestant 2023 kind of life all rolled into one, right? So it's, you know, I think that's what we're supposed to take. And I may or may not have issues with the way that it's being thrust at us, the actuality of what is being thrust at, you know, all of this kind of thing. But I think that's kind of where we're at with this book. That's what the writers and artists and probably DC editorial itself is trying to give us. All of that having been said, it really has nothing to do with where I started. So I apologize if that kind of caused you to turn the podcast off. Turn it back on. Come back. Wildcat is always the, because he just has, he's a human in really good shape. Not quite like Batman, but in really good shape. And so he just, he keeps going. He does what he is able to do and keeps going with the thought that perhaps out of sheer persistence, he will win whatever battle he is in. Solomon Grundy picks up a crate and is about to smush him, and Power Girl leaps up through the wharf, right in front of him, right from between his legs, up through his arms, trashing the crate that Solomon Grundy is holding. She trashes it with a K-R-A-K. Flies up and around, and as we see her circle around, Solomon Grundy has turned around and is now facing Superman as well. So Superman and Power Girl freed themselves from Xanadu's volcanic liquid rock prisons that he put both of them in. As we are still in Tokyo, that is where this Oceanside Wharf is located, is in Tokyo. So Power Girl and Superman both pick Solomon Grundy up, fly him to the volcano that Xanadu caused to form, and drop him in the volcano. So I guess that means he can survive the heat and lava or magma, whichever it is at this point. Because, you know, I don't think really at this stage Superman would kill. Power Girl might, I don't know, but I don't think Superman would. So I guess they assume that he'll live. Cut back to the wharf where Hawkman turns out that he is okay, because in the interim, he has knocked out Fiddler as he's walking around carrying him on his shoulder now like a sack of potatoes. Wildcat is all purry goodness now that he didn't kill his friend Hawkman. They're talking a little bit. Superman comes up, and we see a quick rehash of where we are with Xanadu and Hawkman, Carter Hall's wife, Shera, who Xanadu captured last issue and is using as a focus to channel the energy required for him to enact his magic. And we'll talk about that a little bit more a little bit later in this story, rather than rehashing what was told us last issue. Hawkman is frustrated because, yeah, they've won this battle, but they haven't won the war, meaning they haven't defeated Xanadu and gotten Shera back, because when one of the aspects of this little slower portion of the book here is Superman telling everyone that when he and Power Girl freed themselves, they went back, and all they could find of Xanadu was this after image of he and Shera in the air where they had been before he transported them to wherever they are at this point. Not in Tokyo, obviously. So Hawkman flies up, and he's all bitter about, well, you know, we can't do this, and we can't do that, and we couldn't save our my wife. I'm not even sure we're men. You know, we're not heroes. I'm not even sure we're men. And it's like, wow. A couple other places in this issue and the next couple issues that I already flipped through, and I'll get to that by the end of the show as well. There's a lot of really over-the-top acting in this. If this were a movie or a television series and these were human actors, a lot of over-the-top kind of things coming from a lot of different people, I've thought, as far as an emotional take. It seems that Hawkman and later on Midnight, Dr. Midnight, Our Man momentarily. We're seeing this with Power Girl, a little bit with Wildcat early on, but not too much lately. Everyone seems to be adult in a lot of other aspects, but very juvenile emotionally, I think. And I think what that is it's a technique being used to try to draw us in and help us feel what these men and women would be feeling in these different situations. But I think those emotions are expressed a lot of times a little over the top, particularly for adults with superpowers that put them way in ways superior than the regular humanity would be. But it also exposes them to things that regular humanity would not, and gives them the chance to develop certain traits beyond what a regular human has the opportunity to develop. And one of those is emotionally. So we cut next to Egypt, where we have left Green Lantern and Flash as they are convinced, well, as Green Lantern is convinced, Flash accompanied him, that a cure for what ails Dr. Fate can be found in Egypt. So Lantern went to Egypt. Flash said he would go with him. That's why they're together. So they're there searching the sands of Egypt. They come to that portion of Egypt probably that has the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. I think those are relatively close together. And as they're there wondering what their next move is, they espy a person riding atop a winged horse, a Pegasus. And they say, oh, well, we were looking for something probably supernatural. There's a good place to start. And so thus ends that little interlude. We cut back to the JSA headquarters, which it's interesting because I thought we see Star Spangled Kid, Dr. Midnight, Hourman working on an unconscious Kent Nelson, Dr. Fate. The machinery that is being monitored by Hourman and Midnight, surrounding, applying treatment to Dr. Fate, being powered by Star Spangled Kid's use of Starman's gravity rod. Okay, all of this. I thought this equipment was in a nearby hospital. Last issue, when we first saw it employed, deployed, whichever the ployed word would be most accurate. Here, we're told that all of this equipment, this scene, is in the JSA headquarters. So, last issue, perhaps I erred in saying that it was at the hospital. Perhaps the book was wrong in not telling us that was at JSA headquarters. I don't know. But now, everything is at the Brownstone, probably in one of the lower levels. As we know, the above-ground aspect of the JSA Brownstone has been totally trashed. So, I guess they're in some of the lower levels here working on Dr. Fate. It's not working. Star Spangled Kid finally just runs out of juice, and the star rod kind of blazes unto nova brightness and then just fades into nothing. We see it being held in its mechanical machinery seat here, the cosmic rod. Just smoldering, not destroyed or anything, but just smoking from where it's been used. The monitoring machinery tells everyone that there is no brain activity in Dr. Fate, and our man decides that he is so upset that he punches a portion of this machinery and probably destroys it so that if anything does happen and they can get it restarted, they won't be able to operate it because our man has destroyed part of it. That was my takeaway. Leaving Kent Nelson here, Star Spangled Kid wanders off bemoaning the issue. Our man tells us, I've seen more men die than you can know, kid, in reference to what the Star Spangled Kid said. And it hurts every time just the same. Worse, when you've done all you can and it still wasn't enough. Our man. That was Dr. Midnight. I think I got that right. This is Our Man. Kent Nelson was a good man and he had a good life, a chance to fight for what he believed in, and a chance to die for it as well. I only wish all men could live so nobly and die in as good a cause. Dr. Midnight, there are no good deaths, Our Man. No good causes in which to die. In the end, there's only death, and that's what we fought so hard to prevent. As he and Our Man have turned and are exiting stage away from us in the panel as they're walking. Kind of a cool just thing that struck my eye here. In these last two panels on this page, we see Dr. Fate and Dr. Midnight and Our Man walking towards us, and then they have turned and are walking completely away. Very similarly garbed, very differently colored. Dr. Midnight, green full cape, red tunic, black pants. He's got his mask off. Our Man, yellow full body cape, yellow tunic, yellow leggings under a black bodysuit with short leg. So, and then they turn, and all you see are the two men with capes, one full body green, one with full body yellow. And I just like that aspect that the outfits are similar but different, and then the color. So you, in my mind, can easily recognize either of these gentlemen when you realize what their particular colors are. Anytime you see the outfit, you know, you'll recognize it. It's not this intricate thing that just barely is different from, you know, it's colored, and what articles of clothing they're wearing are different enough that you immediately can tell them apart. That's cool. Don't necessarily run into that a lot with now. There are so many superheroes and supervillains, and they, you know, some of them will look like others, and some will actually be a takeoff, you know, the second or third generation of someone or something. But a lot of these golden age heroes, they looked at what was existing at the time, and I think thought that, well, I want at very least the coloring, if not the entire design, to be different enough that you can just glance and tell the difference. And they were able to do that for the first, you know, 10, 15, 20 superheroes, superheroines that came along. And then after that, things started mixing and matching, and it wasn't as easy to do. As the men are, they're wandering around the room, but they have never left, because suddenly we get an alert telling us that the alien that was in Tokyo is now over the city. The city, I would assume, must be New York City, because I believe that's where the brownstone is located. And so they all, being Star Spangled Kid, Our Man, and Dr. Midnight, rush out to attack Xanadu again, except that Our Man and Star Spangled Kid realize that they zoomed off and they left Dr. Midnight by himself. He is still bemoaning the fact that he was not able to save Kent Nelson, and is alluding to the fact that he may hang up his superhero togs altogether. As I said earlier, I've flipped through the next couple of issues, and no, that's not the case. So Star Spangled Kid with Our Man cannot fly. So he is flying under the power of Star Spangled Kid, go to attack Xanadu, and we see he does indeed have still Shiera Hall here with him. Now, what's happening is Xanadu is using all of the negative emotions that his presence causes in people, whether that be the peoples he's attacking, their fear, their anger, their what have you at what he's doing. He gathers it up, but he can't use it until he passes it through a member of the race whose emotional energies he's harnessing. And all of it goes into that one person he has captive, and then somehow with his magics, from there he's able to transmute it into energy that he can use. And so that's what he is using Shiera for. So she would be what would that be? Kind of like maybe a capacitor, an inductor. I don't remember my electronic components too well. Capacitor stores, and I thought amplifies. Yeah, one or the other. I'll go with capacitor. She's like a human energy capacitor. And he's talking some trash as he's got a interesting necklace I don't think I've noticed here before, too. It's kind of phoenix-y shaped in aspect. Interesting, whenever Xanadu talks, it's a green word balloon with a blue border around it. Those are his speech bubbles. I don't know if that is meant to tell us that he's speaking in a language we don't understand, or he's speaking in some sort of different frequency than what we can understand or something. But I guess we are to take that we have been given a special dispensation to understand what he's saying somehow. You know, the narrator translates, or we have some universal translator stuck in our ear, and we know, but it's completely foreign, but yet we can read it whenever he speaks. I believe he has told us before, but also keep in mind that he is a chaos lord. If we flip those words, he's a lord of chaos, right? Which is interesting, because we know a lord of order right now. I think later on in his history, come to find out that it's not order that he fights for. He fights for chaos, but for the good, using chaos kind of thing. So we'll find that out as we continue our journey. He tells Our Man and Star Spangled Kid to surrender. Never. Our Man somehow, I don't know what he leaps against, but he leaps at Xanadu. Star-Spangled Kid tells him, "Dog, you've leapt out of my force field that kept you flying. Now you're going to fall." So, diverting his attention, Star-Spangled Kid catches him and thinks, well, while I'm doing this, I'll use Hourman. And he focuses not just the ability to keep Hourman aloft using, gravitic waves by the star rod, something like that. But he also imbues a portion of the energy of the star rod into Hourman that Hourman is then, because he is under the effects of the Miraclo, so he's not just human, he's superhuman. He focuses that energy, channels it, and shoots it back at Xanadu, who easily blocks it. Realizing that Hourman is not the issue, that it's actually Star-Spangled Kid, Xanadu shoots some energy at him that Star-Spangled Kid uses the star rod to block, absorb, and reflect back at Xanadu, to the effect that Xanadu tells us, no, for the first time in uncounted eras, Xanadu, third person, right, has been struck a blow. By the lords of Lost Lemuria, you shall pay for this, mortals, and your death will not be a clean one, as he goes flinging across the sky from where he's been repulsed by this blast. So he is tumbling now out of control, falls through the roof, not the roof, the floor, whatever aspect of the brownstone remains, into the medical bay that everyone was originally. So we kind of have a full circle of where the comic, well, it didn't start, but where the story of these particular individuals started, we have come full circle to where they are back physically where they started. So Xanadu now has taken a measure, right, of his foes. He's got the spell. He knows how to win the battle. I would suggest he's probably going to unleash something that will just kill everybody. So he starts summoning the energy. You can almost imagine, you know, all of the human beings. No, they're not doing that. But there's a panel of all the different peoples in the area, and it says, narrator tells us, in the streets around them, 100,000 people pause in their daily task to shiver at a chill that isn't in the air, for it does not take a sensitive person to feel the undercurrent of building chaotic energy as Xanadu marshals his unholy power for a killing blow. So he has requested, he is draining all of this negative energy from the peoples through Shiera, building it up in his body to cast this one final fireball spell that is going to kill everybody. Unfortunately for Xanadu, he is doing this in the vicinity of the formerly dead, Kent Nelson, who we now see is reviving. And we're told, yet for a sensitive, that chill is 1,000 times more intense, cold enough to reach into the grave itself. So maybe that is alluding to the fact that Kent was dead, but not, he was just a little dead. However you want to explain it, his soul is pulled back into his body to animate and energize his body like it normally would do, in order to defeat this major mass of chaos energy that is nearby, as Dr. Fate is a user of order energy. An avatar for the Lords of Order, as perhaps Xanadu is showing himself to be an avatar for the Lords of Chaos. And again, it's not necessarily that simple, but right now it is. Kent Nelson comes back to himself. We see his body start to move, his eyes open, energy starts to pulse through him, and he hits Xanadu with a giant onk of energy from behind, knocking him through other aspects of the building that remains. And as he's picking himself up, he says, it seems you have a master sorcerer in your midst, mortals. Xanadu did not know that. But now that Xanadu knows, he will be prepared and you will finally die. Because he turns, as I guess off to one side is this magician that he now knows is here. But he turns to where we see Star-Spangled Kid, Hourman, Superman, Wildcat, and Power Girl arrayed, ready to defeat him. Another turn sees that Shiera has been freed by Hawkman, so that means that the chaos capacitor that he had, he no longer has access to. Not sure. I guess what that means is that he'll have to make do with the energy that he has stored in his being at this point. And he starts amassing it again, but this time Dr. Fate deals a more telling blow. He completely surrounds Xanadu in the cube rectangle of amber, like he initially was shown to us. He is imprisoned thusly by Dr. Fate. Says, just as the force of this of his enchantment summoned my consciousness back to my body after it had abandoned this existence, so was I able to force him back into imprisonment once his hold over Shara Hall, his focus, was ended. Tonight you have seen a dead man walk and a being who lived millions of years die. That's Kent Nelson, or the wizard speaking through the helmet. His name kind of escapes me for some reason. But we cut to an epilogue where it's just Superman, Power Girl, Wildcat, Star Spangled Kid, Hourman. I said Hourman. Dr. Midnight. They're all talking about what's happened and how it affects them and everything like that. Superman says that he is once again stepping away from the JSA, but he does request that Power Girl be elected to the JSA to take his place. We then finally, the end of the story finally, we cut to a scene of the Injustice Society membership. We've seen a couple members already in The Fiddler and Solomon Grundy. But here we see Icicle is talking to four other individuals that I can't really discern because they're kind of shadowy as to who exactly they are. So I'm not sure who the members of this Injustice Society are, other than Fiddler, Solomon Grundy, and Icicle so far. But they feel that Hourman is a weak link in the JSA, so they're next going to go after him. And the narrator tells us here at the end, will Power, much like who used to do this? Was it the Justice League, the old Justice League cartoon or somebody? Will Power Girl really replace Superman? Who is that mysterious man on Flying Horse, and where did he lead Green Lantern and the Flash? What does the Icicle know that we don't? The answer to these and other questions await you October 21st, when yesterday begins today. And so there we go. That's it for issue 63. Fun issue. I'm starting to get into this volume of All-Star comics a little bit more. As long as you don't have Power Girl being all, I am girl, hear me roar, and anybody else antagonizing her. It has been Wildcat here in one of the issues that I flipped through. It was Star Spangled Kid. And I say flip through because the next two issues of this book, 64 and 65, I will not be talking about. The adventures of the Justice Society lead them to travel through time. They encounter Merlin. They encounter Vandal Savage. The Icicle-led Injustice Society steps out of the shadows and formally attack the Justice Society. We see all of the members arrayed now. Everybody comes back from their time journey. That takes two issues. And when they come back, the story is on its last legs as far as being tied up, but in its last throes of storytelling before they move on to the next story, Dr. Fate gets involved there. So that being said, the next issue that we will be talking about, well, that I will be talking about, I definitely encourage you to go ahead and read 64 and 65 to keep up with what the Justice Society is doing, because it's not boring or uninteresting. I just want to focus on Dr. Fate. He was not involved in either of those issues. Issue number 66 will be the next All-Star Comics issue that I look at. So I invite you to listen in next time as I give my thoughts on that issue. Thanks for voyaging along with me, guys. I will see you hopefully again next week. Ciao.